This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. For most Americans, oil and coal is the primary source of energy, but reliance on fossil fuels is contributing to global warming, and that poses a threat to the future of this planet. Much of the discussion around mitigating climate change centers on renewable energy like solar and wind power. But a few people are talking about another power source, of course, nuclear energy. But fear about safety and expense have hindered the development of nuclear power as a sustainable energy source for the United States. Anyway, my next guest hopes to change all of that. Eric Lowen is chief consulting engineer at GE Hitachi's nuclear facility in Wilmington, North Carolina. He is the past president of the American Nuclear Society, and he leads a team at GE to develop fourth-generation nuclear power, which is a source that he says is more powerful and, he says, safer than any prior nuclear energy sources. Eric Lowen joins me today on the State of Things. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Frank, thanks for having me.
I want to talk more about nuclear energy and all of that, but I want to find out how you came to this business. You grew up in Colorado, and you remember Jimmy Carter's calls for energy conservation, right, growing up?
I did, and my mom listened better than most, and our house was kept at 58 degrees overnight, which was quite cold. And so that was kind of the first awakening of that we needed something for this nation to do with energy. And I had a great mentor as a chemistry high school teacher, Mr. Marta, and that in a combination with a community college of a professor named Dr. Fox, who taught me technical mathematics, it kind of launched me on this career of science.
It was a mining town, essentially, that you grew up in, right?
It was. So Leadville, Colorado was a mining town. Back in the day in the 1800s, it mined silver, so the unsinkable Molly Brown, and those stories are true. And
it was called Leadville, though?
Still is.
Shouldn't it have been Silverton?
Silverton or Silverville, both of which were taking.
Ah.
And they got Leadville because it was the next, lead was the next major constituent with those atoms. And
they consulted the periodic table?
Apparently. So lead is also a byproduct of this particular ore.
I see.
And they named it, and it was almost going to be the state capital back in the day.
Wow.
In the 1800s because of the economy revolved, because it was so big. Better minds decided Denver would be a better place to have it, and So Denver ended up being the capital.
But mining is an extractive industry, obviously, and it rises and falls. And, of course, this is what we're facing now. In addition to global warming and fossil fuels and what they do to our air, you know, we're going to run out someday. And so this is why you're interested these days in this alternative form. But let's talk more about this. So you're in this community, and it was interesting because I understand that you were really pretty closely students – where you grew up were pretty closely tracked in terms of where they were going to go in their continuing education, right?
They were. And in junior high, they decided, you took some exam or, I don't know, some sort of meeting, and they had three tracks, vocational, general education, or college tracked. And I got put in the middle with being generally tracked and started my career that way.
And you, in terms of science, you mentioned a science teacher who's very important to you, and I want to hear that story in a minute. But up until you met that teacher, had science been any part of your dream of the future?
It had not. My dream of the future was to be a ski racer, to win a gold medal in downhill ski racing, remembering the film from Robert Redford called Downhill Racer. So that was where all my energies were put. And because I was taking half days off during the wintertime to ski, when the ski season was over, my mom rightly recognized that I needed to do something. And because she worked at the community college, then I enrolled and took some classes up there my junior and senior year. And that opened me up because then I was out of my track of general. I was in a community college. I didn't have that baggage from the school district, if you will. And so that's when things really came alive as far as mathematics and science for
me. This is fascinating because if you had just, you know, not been a ski bum and a slacker, you would have stayed on that general track and never become the accomplished scientist you are. So kids,
correct.
This is the lesson, really. Slack off and go skiing and your life. It's a joke, of course, but it's kind of true in your case.
But yeah. I think for children, I think you need to have passion
exactly.
in an area and you
exactly.
try to achieve excellence.
Yeah.
And if you do that and you fall short because you're aiming for the moon, then you'll hit the stars.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that you have to have a passion to keep yourself going.
A passion to keep going. And you met this teacher. And tell us about that, about how that really inflamed your interest in science.
So the first teacher was Mr. Marta, who was the teacher from the beginning of all ages that we could tell. He was a chemistry teacher, very hard-nosed. And what always amazed me is how excited he was about science. And as kids, we just thought, how could you be this excited? Because you've taught this like for 50 years, or not 50 years, but so long. But he was the one that opened up my eyes to chemistry, and you could explain much of life with chemistry.
Well, I want to get back to that joke I was making about slacker, because or ski bum, for instance. You were passionate about skiing. In fact, you made the Junior Olympics. Am I right?
Correct.
So you have a passion, and you understand what passion is. It's skiing. And then you recognize that in another human being, and it happens to be about science. You recognize that this is the same thing I'm feeling, only I feel it for skiing, and this guy's really excited about science.
Correct. At the time, I didn't realize. I would call it wisdom of old age that I realized why he's such a good teacher, because he had that passion.
So what did that do for you? From that point forward, then, can you change tracks, or how did you get into the science channel?
Then, because I was taking classes up at the college, I leapt ahead of my peers in the school and took calculus, and they felt defrauded, if you will. How come Lowen is taking calculus because he hasn't sat through geometry and trigonometry like we had to? And then I realized that calculus is this beautiful thing of the connection of our world with mathematics, where algebra and all this other stuff, you need those tools, but you can't describe nature.
Hmm.
You have to describe nature with calculus because it's infinitesimal, it's big, it's changes, it's not constant. And that's, so I did that, and then I got a ski scholarship to go to Western State College in Gunnison, Colorado. Showed up on campus, what will my major be? It's like, well, I like math and I like chemistry, and that's the track I headed down.
Ski scholarship, so there we are again. And then you met a Navy recruiter who came to campus, right?
Navy recruiter showed up on campus, and I had just finished working as a summer intern at Rio Blanco Oil Shale Company in Rifle, Colorado. So I got to see what it was like to extract oil from rocks and the detriments therein of what it did to the surrounding infrastructure and what sort of things it produced, both sour water and sour gas that were pretty toxic. And being a lab chemist doing all the wet chemistry for environmental monitoring, it got boring at the end of the summer. And then when the Navy recruiter showed up with a picture of a officer driving a submarine to defend our nation against communism, because this is circa 1982, So the Cold War was still a big issue.
Yeah.
I took the chance because the recruiter said, oh, you're a science major, you'll do just fine. So that's how I shifted tracks, if you will.
Yeah.
Still in science, but it was using that background into that smaller science of the nucleus of an atom.
A little more glamorous life. Glamorous for almost everybody except for your father and his family, which was your father had come from a long line of pacifists, right?
Yes, my father was raised a Mennonite, and he was one of eight. So his very first brother went off to the Korean War. And the way he rationalized it was, I wouldn't be a pacifist if somebody came and stole my chicken. I wouldn't be a pacifist if somebody started farming on my land. I would fight and defend that. So I felt that I needed to do the same thing. So then his next brother went, and then my father, the youngest, ended up enlisting in the Army during the 60s, and his program, because he had a kid or two, he just had to do reserves and was never sent to Vietnam.
How did they feel about you signing up with the Navy?
So my dad cried. And the reason why he cried, he's bedridden. He had multiple sclerosis in the last stages of it, if you will. And he looked at a son that had all this potential to do radical things and ski and that kind of stuff. And I told him I'd be contained on a submarine. He just thought that was the wrong sort of thing. So it was a very surprising reaction from a father. Not, I'm proud of you, you're serving your country and you're going to be an officer. It was tears of, why did you do that? That seems like a mistake. He ended up dying 18 months after that, so he never got to see me in uniform. He never got to see, the ships that I was on and that kind of stuff, so that's kind of a hole in my heart.
It does seem a little bit odd that you would choose a submarine having loved the slopes. If I think about the freedom of skiing, the last place I could imagine being is in a torpedo or in a submarine.
So, Frank, I thought the same way, but that's how I got recruited. The recruiter that I had, Rich High, wanted to make recruiter of the year, and he had too many people in submarines. So after I was in the program, finishing my last year of college, he called us up and said, we'd like you to switch to go on surface ships. And it's a financial penalty because you do get subpay and you get a lot of other incentives for Submarine Force. So it had to be voluntary. So they flew us out to San Diego and they took us on, I think, the worst submarine they could find and gave us a tour. And the crew was disgruntled. I don't think the Navy planned this, but one of the people as I was walking up the ladder to get out goes, "Don't join." Run away.
Okay.
Then we went across to North Island and I got on the first nuclear powered warship, which was called the USS Long Beach. And it was, and I stood on the bridge and it's 13 stories above the water. And I looked over at the captain. I go, "Do you get to drive this?" He goes, "Yeah, you'll be driving the ship." So I switched. And as fate turned out, 4 or 5 years later, I got assigned to that ship and became a ship driver on the Long Beach in the Persian Gulf.
And we will pursue this story. I'm talking with Eric Lowen. He's the chief consulting engineer for GE Hitachi's nuclear facility at Wilmington, North Carolina. Just ahead, we'll learn how terrifying military experience solidified his passion for nuclear energy. We'll find out more about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow talking with Eric Lowen today, chief consulting engineer at GE's nuclear facility at Wilmington. We left you in San Diego on the bridge of a very large nuclear-powered warship called the Long Beach, and you decided that that might not be a bad idea. You went to school for training, right, for nuclear training, I guess.
Correct. The Navy has a one-year program that takes college graduates and also people from high school in two different tracks to teach you about the technology on that's used on Navy warships.
They had a grading system, a seating plan, and you didn't come out so good on that.
So it was an interesting approach. I don't think we get by with in our public schools. And for you teachers out there, this is how it worked. The first day we showed up and had an exam. And based on that exam is where you sat in the class. Smartest kids in the back, dumbest up front. So yours truly was one away from the door up front. And the way the different instructors would come in is they would explain a concept and they would look condescendingly down at the first row people and say, "Do you guys understand?" And if you sat in the front row, you got mandatory study hours of 20 hours a week when you first showed up. And it was a different sort of environment as far as what I was used to in the public school system.
Well, how did you do in that environment? I mean, did you at a certain point understand, or did you feel like you were in just a little over your head when you got started?
I felt over my head coming from a liberal arts college. It was a little bit because there was a lot of big-name universities there of people that were mechanical engineers and chemical engineers and electrical engineers. So they had a more rigorous background in the engineering. But in chemistry, in the math section, it was very easy for me. And then thermodynamics was a little bit tougher. So I struggled during that 6 months. The next 6 months is where the Navy puts you on a real running reactor system. At that time, they were land-based in Idaho. And you had 6 months to learn how to qualify. So in that case, as an officer, you had to stand all the enlisted watch stations and then finally stand what's called engineering officer of the watch. You had to interact. You had to communicate. You had to lead. And so in that, I ended up finishing second. So I went from almost finishing last at nuclear power school to finishing second at the prototype.
And that's in Idaho. So now you're
in Idaho.
All right. So what happens next? You decide then to take a position as an instructor, right?
The Navy had a program where they were trying to pick up freshly graduated officers to be an instructor for a year. And they were really trying to support the returning lieutenants who had just been out to sea for 3 years, and they had shore duty. Well, shore duty in Idaho was 8 to 12 hours a day and a lot of work, and a lot of them were leaving the Navy. So they felt, let's give an extra pair of hands to this person, and we'll give them an ensign. So that was my rank at the time. And so then I became an instructor for other officers learning how to operate a nuclear-powered system.
But there was another component to this, wasn't there, in terms of the kind of duty that you would do and the contract that you had with the Navy, right?
So when I signed up with the Navy, I owed them 3 years of sea duty after I finished. And being a young ensign of not much intelligence, I thought the Navy didn't so I thought I'd trick them by doing 1 year of shore duty in Idaho, or 1 year of duty, and I could continue to be a ski racer and win all the citizens' races, and then I'd only have 2 years out at sea. So I finally got my orders a month after being into that job and noticed my end of obligated service was extended a year. I called up the person in Washington, D.C. and said, "Sir, there's a mistake on my orders. I've been extended a year." And he said, "No, Ensign, there's no mistake." And I used some foul language to him, and he responded back, "I will have you on the worst ship on the West Coast in 1 week if you don't accept these orders. So I accepted the orders and served my country one extra year.
You ended up on a ship. What was that, and where were you?
So the ship I ended up a year later was the USS Long Beach, that one that shifted me from being in the submarines below water to being, as they call it, a target above water. And so I got on the Long Beach, and during my 3 years aboard the Long Beach, I had two six-month tours where you're gone from port for 6 months, then 2 3-month tours where you're gone from port.
And that service took you to the Persian Gulf.
The last tour of the 6 months ended up in the Persian Gulf. Because I'd been on the ship long enough, my engineering obligation, if you will, was fulfilled. It was time to be more of a naval officer, so I was expected to become a ship driver. And so I was one of the four officer of the decks that drove the ship, if you will, while we were at the Persian Gulf.
And it was a big ship.
It was very big.
So how did it feel to actually be behind the wheel, as I'm sure they don't say in the Navy?
It's stressful. You have a watch team. Yeah. It's not you by yourself. Yeah. So you have a person called the lee helm that's going how fast in the helm, the person that's steering the ship, and a bosun's mate that's making sure of the watch standards and navigation person. Then you have a junior officer of the deck. So it's a team effort to be able to do that. But it was stressful. Yeah. I can't say it wasn't.
All the more so when you were actually attacked, or there was a threat of an attack.
We were threatened. What had happened, a little bit of history, the United States, President Reagan gave 11 flags to Kuwait to put on their oil tankers so that they were U.S. flagged. And so the United States sent 13 ships to escort those ships. Our obligation was at the 13th mile through the 600 miles of the Persian Gulf out to the Straits of Hormuz. And at the time, to remind your listeners, Iran and Iraq were in a very bloody war. And they were jealous that Kuwait was still shipping product out. So that's why they are attacking their tankers. Now with the U.S. flag, they stopped. One of those tankers was getting refueled, but was within the 12-mile radius and wasn't under our jurisdiction to protect them. Iran launched a Sukhoi missile and attacked that ship. So what showed up on the news and probably on NPR was that a U.S. ship had been attacked. It's true that it had a U.S. flag, but it was owned by Country A, piloted by Country B, and registered in Country C, so it was definitely multinational. So our response as a nation 1 week later was to blow up an Iranian oil platform, and some of the listeners will remember that was what was called Black Monday when the stock market fell, and we were attributed to causing that stock market crash for a variety of reasons. A week later is when I was coming on to watch, and this is to the point of your question. It was a Sunday, and I thought we're going back and forth because Iran went public to say, you've attacked holy ground, we're going to do holy jihad, those sort of things. And when I came up on watch that Sunday, we were 50 miles off the coast of Iran in the Gulf of Oman, going back and forth. And the other ships that attacked were on R&R, if you will, and they were anchored off the coast of Somalia. Took over the watch. 2 hours into the watch, Iran let off a radar, which meant they were sending their airplanes out. They launched an F-4, which we previously sold them during Shah of Iran, and that F-4 started coming at us. The captain's on the bridge with me. Captain leans forward because he was leaning back in his chair, said, Lieutenant Lowen, come up to 25 knots. Paid to follow orders, I did. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I'm going 5 knots, I'm going to 25, and a 600-knot missile's coming at me. I don't think we're going to outrun them, but I was paid to take orders. Then from our combat information center, they're talking about this airplane that's getting closer and closer. Then I flash back to my friend John, who was on the bridge wing of the USS Stark about 13 months before, where he watched two Exocet missiles slam into the side of his ship and 112 sailors lost their lives. So I'm thinking I'm right in the middle of this. We then put on our fire control radar to let them know that we were painting them and we could shoot a missile. Fortunately for all considered, they turned around to 30 miles away from our ship. The captain leaned back in his chair, took a sip of coffee, and said, Lieutenant Lowen, get us back down to 5 knots. And at that point, it was the epiphany for me to say, I like this technology of nuclear power, but I don't want to escort anymore, and I don't want to be in the Persian Gulf anymore. And so that was where I did my definition of, I want to get out, I want to learn more about nuclear science and technology. Serve my country, but I don't want to do it for a career.
You couldn't exactly swim to shore, but when you finally were let out of the service, you decided to go back to grad school.
I did. So at the time, there was 31 different schools that had reactors. I offered to run that reactor for exchange of getting a free education. Because I went to a liberal arts college, I didn't understand what research assistants were and graduate assistants and teaching assistants that they actually pay you to go to school. And they said, no, we have technicians that do that. So I settled on three schools, Purdue, Tennessee, and Wisconsin, got accepted to all three. And then it was like, now what do I do? So I defaulted back to what my passion was, skiing. And out of those three states, Frank, which
you're going to go to Wisconsin.
So I went to Wisconsin because they have the largest they have the largest cross-country race in North America, which is called the Berkey.
Wow. And so you were in both downhill and cross-country.
Correct.
Wow.
So it's a 50-kilometer race.
Yeah.
You're lucky if you don't get frostbite if it's too cold. And that's why I went to Wisconsin. I didn't tell that to Purdue, so I'm going on record now. Purdue and Oak Ridge, I gave a different reason why I didn't come to their program, more scientific, but that was a real reason.
So you went there, although did you finish there?
So I initially, when I signed up, I got a master's degree and then started working on a PhD and then went into the private sector, then returned and got my PhD in nuclear engineering.
You also became a father at that time, around
yep,
then?
Yep, father in, yes, I did.
So what are you thinking now? Where are you headed at this point? Obviously, you don't want to be floating around the Persian Gulf anymore. You've ruled that out.
Mm-hmm.
But you do want to pursue nuclear technology. So what are you thinking you're going to do?
I want to get out to industry and be a part of a team to build the next reactor. And when I left the program early, after I finished my master's degree, there was an opportunity to work with a startup company out of Boston called Molten Metal Technology, and they needed a nuclear engineer to disposition radioactive waste. And it seemed like a good fit because that was kind of the holdup. We weren't building new reactors then, circa 1992. And so I took that chance with a technology company. I was the 50th employee. It went public, had many stock options and those sort of things. Unfortunately, we went bankrupt because we were trying to solve all the world problems in parallel simultaneously. And we forgot to make money.
That was the big one. Now, was that because you didn't make money because you couldn't really do it? I mean, that is the problem. What do we do with the waste? And there's a lot of it, and it's dangerous, and it lives for a long, long time. That's my scientific understanding of the problem of nuclear waste.
That's a good understanding. And the opportunity that I had with jumping forward in the story was to work with GE Hitachi Nuclear Energy World Headquarters in Wilmington, North Carolina, to use this reactor called PRISM to disposition what we call nuclear, what you call nuclear waste. I call it used fuel because I see it as a fuel source for the future.
I want to get there in a minute, but I do want to see at that juncture what the problem was. And where was the technology? What was the understanding of how you would, at that point, not reuse essentially or find another way to make this into fuel, but dispose of it? What was the, where was the theory? Where, what direction were you heading in with that company?
So with Molten Metal Technology, we were after the waste that's called low-level waste. And the biggest waste that comes from nuclear power plants is a function of volume and the amount of radioactivity in it is the resins that are used to clean up the water. So it's a huge volume. So the idea was to use this technology to reduce the volume, extract the products that are non-radioactive, and put those radioactive elements in a metallic and a ceramic waste form that was more robust. And then that would be buried.
All right. So you want to isolate the really dangerous stuff and really, really, really protect it. I mean, that's the idea. Come up with a robust way of protecting. Because otherwise, you've got all the stuff that is one way or another contaminated. But if we could extract the truly the contaminants from that stuff, which wouldn't be if we could render it clean, then we have less to deal with.
Correct. So in the room that we're sitting in here, that's how typically the containers would come. Then the idea was we'd reduce the volume of the radioactive material stuff to about the size of a large water ball, water bottle, and the rest of that organic stuff in the resin isn't radioactive, and then we can use that as a fuel.
Sounds like a great idea. What went wrong? Was it the cost or was it the science that didn't work?
We were doing radioactive stuff, plus we were doing chemical weapons, plus we were doing chlorinated organics from oil companies, plus we were doing auto shredder residue, so we got too thin technically and never executed on one thing.
It's the business model.
It was a business model. So the technology worked. The plant operated, and you know we were working out the bugs, but we had other misses across the portfolio of the company, and it caused it to go bankrupt.
What about that technology? It seems to me that if that were in widespread use now, it would go a long way to easing fears about what we do with nuclear waste. Is that in production? Does anybody do that?
Not to my knowledge. the people don't use a molten metal bath for those low-level radioactive waste. It would also be good for our nation for when we shred up autos like they do in Europe.
Also, you ended up going to D.C. and worked as a congressional fellow.
I did. So one of the things I would tell your listeners that are going to college, you're going to college to get a career, and part of being a career is being part of a professional society. So my professional society, since I've been in the business, is American Nuclear Society, and they had a fellowship program that was brokered under the larger American Association for the Advancement of Sciences. I had the opportunity to be a fellow and had many offers, and I ended up working with Senator Hagel, who was a Republican at the time from Nebraska.
All right, and what was your job? What were you doing?
So I showed up. Senator Hagel, for those that know the climate history, passed a resolution in 1997 called the Byrd-Hagel Resolution that said 95-0, we don't support Kyoto. And so when Vice President Gore went to Kyoto and signed, but we didn't ratify the treaty, he had a fairly firm stance of the Senate that the treaty was biased and against U.S. interests. Okay. Mm. So that's what the Senate.
That was
if you look at the vote,
that
was a resolution.
Bill that killed Kyoto.
It was a resolution.
A resolution that
and so President Clinton never brought it in front of the Senate to ratify because of that no vote. Senator Hagel wasn't against climate change. He was just against Kyoto Protocol.
Yeah.
So he wanted to draft some legislation to have a technology approach. So in 2004, he had a staffer, Amy, that was working on it. And then when I showed up as a congressional fellow, very naive, the chief of staff hands me this draft legislation and says, your job is to get that passed this year. And I said, sure, no problem. And at the time, we were allowed to have, it was fair, it was legal that you could have lunch with lobbyists. So I remember my first lunch with a lobbyist from the Chamber of Commerce, and I told him, you know, my job is to pass this bill. And he just kind of like patted me on the shoulder, you know, grasshopper, there's no way you're ever going to get this through.
That's right.
And to jump to the, you know, it's a long story short, but President Bush signed it into law in New Mexico, August 8th, 2005. And if you flip back to chapter 16, you'll see a chapter that says climate change. So this nation does have a climate policy. It's technology-based. It uses greenhouse gas intensity. Then Senator Clinton, then Senator Obama, then Senator Inhofe, and many others voted for it for inclusion in the energy bill. So it was really an exciting opportunity to support a senator like Senator Hagel in getting this legislation through.
But it almost got scotched by an encounter your daughter had at a reception. Am I right? You got a little...
No, my daughter actually helped the program.
Okay.
In the context that our two children, we did not put them into school while we were in D.C. We called it the three M's. They had to go to museums. They had to learn music. And they had to do math, the sex and math program. So she came to work with me one day. I went to go see Senator Pryor's staffer about trying to get a Democrat onto this bill because we needed to have bipartisan to get it to pass.
Right.
The Democrats have put a pretty hard line. Don't work with Republicans on climate change because it's our issue and we're not going to give anything to them. So I show up again trying to meet this particular person, and my daughter's with me, and he asks her, tell me about Senator Hagel's climate change bill. And my daughter, Zaytha, proceeded to tell him.
How old is she?
She's 12 years old
okay.
this time.
Okay.
Proceeds to tell him why you need to have this legislation and all this stuff. And it wasn't that I prompted her. I wasn't, your mission to save the world is to save these things. He just randomly asked her. And he'll tell the story even today saying, because this person had taught his daughter this, I trust him. Therefore, I'm going to recommend to the senator. So Senator Pryor was the very first Democrat to get on, and that allowed us to break through, if you will, to get things going.
Meanwhile, you got a call the next day, or was it that day?
So the other story we kind of confused was that my second to last day on the Hill, my daughter is again at work with me. We stopped by a holiday party at the Mining Association. The senior person that was there was the governor from North Dakota. And Senator Hagel helped or was part of his election process to get him. So they knew each other, unbeknownst to me. And my daughter, as I was in the back, had a lot of different friends and would go to these parties now. Again, 12, and had her own friends. So I'm standing with some of my friends. Many of them are lobbyists, if you will. And we look across the room, and there she's having a conversation with the dignitary, the governor. And it was getting awkward because it wasn't the 2 minute, "Hi, little blonde girl, pat you on the head." It was like 15 minutes and they're having a great conversation. But all the other people that wanted to meet the governor and those sort of things, like, how do we get rid of this girl? So it was this kind of awkward thing. And then we walked out and she was in tears going, "I don't want to leave this town. I love it." And so it was then the following day when the chief of staff called me up with some foul language saying, "What were you doing interacting with the governor of North Dakota? You should have known better." Because there is a hierarchy on what staff can and cannot do, which I respect, because you're there to serve the elected official. Yeah. So I explained the story just as I'd done to your listeners, and she laughed, and so that's how it was.
All went clear. Well, we'll find out a little bit more about those policies, what they actually did get enacted into law, and whether or not there can be safe nuclear technology. As I continue my conversation with Eric Lowen, who is the chief consulting engineer at GE's nuclear facility in Wilmington. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. I'm talking with Eric Lowen, chief consulting engineer at GE's nuclear facility in Wilmington. So your daughter's making a splash in Washington, D.C., which leads you to decide it's time to leave, right?
Correct. and it's a one-year fellowship, and that's how the program's designed. Yeah. AAAS will say 50% of their congressional fellows never leave D.C. So I was the half that left because I wanted to learn about the legislative process as a technical person to be able to communicate those sort of things and understand policy. But yet I wanted to go back to my roots technically. So I returned back to Idaho Falls, to Idaho National Laboratory.
Let me ask you about that legislation. Tell me what that does, because that is, as you say, our sort of our energy and global warming policy. And it's based on technology. What's the theory? How are we going to be saved from global warming through that legislation?
So there's different – so the Kyoto Protocol, very simply, was a cap and trade. We're going to cap the emissions at some, you can call it random, some sort of level, you know, what was a basis for it. And then we're going to do economic penalties or different things to do that. Senator Hagel's approach was completely different from that. It was, let's use technology. And eventually, we have to shift to a different technology. So let's measure this thing called greenhouse gas intensity. So this is where you had to divide two numbers. How much carbon dioxide do you produce versus your gross domestic product? And you want to get that as low as you can. Mm-hmm. So some random numbers. China at the time was 4. The European Union was 0.4. United States was 0.7. But the place where we were doing our most manufacturing was in China, which was 4, which meant they didn't have a very low intensity. So the idea was how to shift technologies to low polluting technologies for carbon. And so that's how we use this greenhouse gas intensity to compare between countries.
Right.
But you could use that same intensity to compare against technologies or against companies. And I think it works better.
Well, how does that change the technology? Because one of the things we learned is that by not approving Kyoto, the U.S. lost out, particularly to Germany, but at any technologically advanced country, because those other countries got busy trying to get their numbers down and get them into compliance. And that stimulated huge multi-billion dollar industries that advanced their GDPs. And we were left behind in that because we didn't sign. There wasn't the incentive to reach those numbers. And we lost out in a technological field where we should have been ahead.
Frank, I'd have to disagree with you for the first time. I don't think we've lost out. If you look at how many windmills that we've placed in this country, what we're doing for solar panels, we just have a bigger energy park, if you will. And I think we're in that leadership role. Now, have we reduced our greenhouse gas intensity as much as we could? No, but I wouldn't blame it on us not signing Kyoto because, you know, I'll stick with Senator Hagel and 95 senators. It was unfair to the United States. What Americans don't realize, there was a tax of your that the United States had to pay to give to the UN to do different. So there was a lot of underlying things in Kyoto that didn't come to surface. And then the number they picked was, let's pick 7% from 1992. Well, where did 1992 come from? Because the world got together in Rio. Well, why not pick 1990? Well, why not 1900? So it wasn't a scientifically based thing. It was, let's cap it at a certain level. So I think as you look at those other economies, I think there's a place for greenhouse gas intensity. You see that at COP21.
What is that?
COP is called Cooperation of the Parties. So the COP3 was Kyoto. It had a name.
So let's talk about the nuclear technology and what eventually led you to Wilmington, North Carolina.
It did. So I was in Idaho, got a phone call from this place called Wilmington. I thought it was in Delaware, but they actually have another one.
There's another one here, yeah.
North Carolina. It's by the ocean. And they offered me this job to be the one to take this technology called Prism off the shelf. The person that was doing it at the time was Chuck Boardman. He retired in 2000. The government changed their policy on looking at advanced reactors under the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. GE wanted to be a part of that to bring the technology back, and so they asked me to lead that. So it was an easy fit because I was working on advanced reactors in Idaho that were lead-cooled, and so I had to shift from the Yankees to the Mets, if you will, from lead to sodium. And at the time when I was a lead person, I hated sodium people, and now I don't like lead people, but I'm on the sodium team.
All right. Well, instruct me now. So tell me about this PRISM technology and sodium based cooling system that you're working on.
So it's an advanced reactor, and what I mean by that, it uses neutrons that have high energy. So all the water reactors that we have run around the world, the 423 of them, all use water as a coolant, and all the neutrons are slow. So it'll be like a propeller plane. This advanced reactor uses liquid sodium, keeps the neutrons' energy high, so they're faster. So it'll be like a jet airplane. So it takes that technology, and if I use faster neutrons, then I can use different fuels and I get better efficiency.
And the reason we're using slower ones now is because, and I think I once heard the analogy of a sort of a baseball game. Basically, a slower pitch is easier to hit.
It is. So that's called cross-sections.
All right.
And the unit of measurements is barns.
Okay.
Broadside of a barn. So the nuclear physicists in the day had some humor.
Yeah.
It's a very, very small number. And that is correct. You want to slow them down. But in a fast spectrum, you configure the core differently. And you can run on fast neutrons, and there's a lot of benefits.
All right. That. So is one of them I actually use up more of the fuel and therefore have less waste? Is that
correct? So our current water-cooled reactors, I don't care who sells them, use 1% of the available energy in uranium. 1%. They're still competitive in the context, but 99% of that's just tossed away. PRISM, with recycling using a thing called electrochemistry, we approach 99%. So when we look at our future as a world community on what energy source, do we want to use one that uses 1% of available energy, or do you want to start heading stuff that uses 99%?
And are these in operation now?
There's nothing in operation now. No. There was one in Idaho called Experimental Breeder Reactor No. 2, and it operated for 30 years, and it was shut down in 1994.
So it was shut down. It was working. So then why not employ it now? Can you? I mean, obviously, it's very difficult to get a permit to build a new nuclear plant. We understand that that's not easy to do these days. Can you easily convert a nuclear plant to this other system, or doesn't it work that way?
So for a utility that has a nuclear reactor in their portfolio, on that site, they would just buy a PRISM reactor, okay? Mm-hmm. And they could use this technology to put electricity onto the grid. And in the United States, to use the used nuclear fuel that we have, there's no policy construct to do that because we decided on a policy in 1982, we amended it in 1987, that what we wanted to do with that used fuel, that waste, is just stick it in a deep geological repository. So what we're offering is to say, hey, that's a great energy source. We can use that. Let's be more sustainable, and that's what the technology promise is.
PRISM technology would allow you to use stuff that's already in storage now and put it back in the fuel tank.
Put it back in the fuel tank. Different fuel tank.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that takes care of problem number one, if it all works, and that is it radically reduces the amount of waste, and of course that's a serious problem. Now the question of safety: what if this thing blows up? Is it any less likely to take out a city than any other nuclear reactor?
It is different fundamentally for two reasons. So the fundamental thing with nuclear power on safety is: can you operate it safely when it's at power, and then can you remove the heat after you shut it down? So what's unique about the technology that I've been a part of is that when you turn it off, it still generates heat. It's 7% initially, and it decreases exponentially. And if you don't remove that heat, you have problems. So that's what happened at Three Mile Island. They didn't remove the heat, and 2.5 hours later, the core melted. And then at Fukushima, to the credit and the heroism of those operators, they went not hours, but in case one of the reactors, 3 days. But because they didn't have power, it got to where they had core damage. So that's one facet. Then controlling it, we see the example at Chernobyl. That reactor was running. It was making electricity. And for a variety of different reasons, they lost control of it because it had a positive feedback, and it produced 3 times its rated power in a second. So it'd be like being in your car, going 3 times faster than its rated speed in a snap of a finger. So with PRISM, the way we deal with that, as far as the power excursion, we have a negative feedback. So if temperature goes up or power goes up, the power turns. Because I'm in a fast spectrum and because of the baseball analogy that you talked about, more neutrons leak out of the core. And that's where we have what's called inherent safety, where we use physics, as Feynman would say.
That all sounds good as long as there's not something like an earthquake that starts to actually break the foundation and crack up the containment and all of that. I mean, what happens in that kind of a catastrophe?
You didn't let me get to the second half. So on this thing, remove the decay heat. I'll come to your earthquake.
Get to the second. Okay, go ahead.
The second thing is how to remove this decay heat. So PRISM does that with no electricity, no operator action. We have air that comes down and removes it. So we can remove that heat forever with no operator action, no fancy electronics.
It's just how it's designed.
Bernoulli's equation. If you believe in Bernoulli's equation, and hot air rises, both in Washington, D.C. and in this PRISM reactor thing, things work. Now, to your earthquake, the way PRISM is built, it's the only reactor that is built on seismic isolation bearings. So a typical reactor in the United States is rated to 0.3 Gs. The reactors in Japan are to 0.5 Gs. Because this system is rated to 1.0 Gs because we have these isolators. That technology is proven in L.A. Many of the buildings use that to support the building, and same with Tokyo.
All right, so you've got this construction then, this kind of engineering this engineering safeguard built in. Obviously, there's the earthquake you never anticipated. But then the ultimate question is, you know, as we learned at 9/11, people use our own weapons and our own technology against us. We've got this giant, it's a generator until a terrorist turns it into a bomb. And now none of what you've built in as a safeguard is going to help us. And that thing is more dangerous than a coal reactor or anything else in my neighborhood.
It is not. And with the PRISM reactor, the reactor vessel is 50 feet below grade. And I'll bet on dirt anytime over airplane impact. And that's where, and we're underground so that I can remove that heat with this natural circulation because I need that height between the vent and where the bottom where the heat is. And because of that, I stretched it, if you will, from a design standpoint and put it underground. So that makes for the technology to be robust against airplane impact events.
No, but I'm not talking about airplane. I'm talking about a deliberate terrorist assault on a plant where I've done some planning, and my goal is to blow this up and release the energy over the nearby population.
It would be, I don't know how you do that. So if you tried to blow it up, you got all this concrete and the reactor would shut down. So it would be subcritical and you would crack some of the concrete or something. So I don't see how to do it. If you got in there and said, I'm going to pull the control rods out to make it go up in power, then you've forgotten that I told you that it has this negative heat or negative effect to where if it heats up or power goes up, it inherently shuts us down. That's inside the core. So that's what makes this technology a lot more robust in the context that those natural things that we know about and some of those unknown unknowns are protected, if you will, with this defense in depth.
We can't get it's hard to get financing for this, and I suspect it has to do with public perceptions. But if the science is good, can we not convince Wall Street, for instance, to invest in this? Because what we're seeing now is that, for instance, Duke Energy says, well, we want to upgrade our nuclear, but can't really get financing on the street. So would you mind just paying higher bills for a while, and we will socialize the cost of that because there we market economics work a little differently. Suddenly we're socialists. So this is the problem, and that Wall Street says, not a good bet. Now, that sounds like good technology. I guess that public perception might be lagging, but can't you convince investors that this is actually going to make it? What's holding this up?
In the United States, for a utility to be able to build PRISM, they would need a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And if we look at the history of our water-cooled reactors, both offered by GE and Westinghouse, that process takes about 10 years. In that 10 years, you're paying the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, because they're a fee-based organization, north of $250 an hour. And they're asking you questions, which is their job. And then you are paying your engineers to answer those questions. So from an investment standpoint, that's unbounded. You don't know how much it's going to cost and how long it's going to take. And to the credit of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Department of Energy, they're looking at different workshops that I've participated in on how do we reduce that cost uncertainty? Because until we do that as a technology group, then we're not going to get those investments from Wall Street. Because I've always said, I can tell you how much this costs once I get through licensing. Because in that licensing process, as it should be, the regulatory said, you know, I don't want you to have blue Tar Heel rooms. I want it to be red because that'll wake people. You know, those sort of changes definitely add costs. So we need to get through that process. And how do we do that is the big question.
Well, let me ask you this, or why should we? And the reason I would ask that is to compare it to, say, renewables. So the problem for renewables tends to be when it comes to solar storage, right? We just can't seem to crack that nut. But obviously, if you can apply the engineering and the scientific will to nuclear technology as it has evolved to the point where you have PRISM technology, you could do the same. I mean, do you think it's impossible to get to the point where renewable energy could supply all of our energy needs if we applied ourselves, if we really focused on, I mean, is it impossible? I get the sense in talking to people, well, you'll never get there. We'll never get there.
I can't speak for renewables, but I will speak that PRISM is renewable energy. And the reason why it's renewable is because it's using what society thinks is waste. It can have different fuel forms, not only uranium, but thorium. And I look at it as a renewable because it can last for however long humanity is going to last on Earth. So I would put PRISM as a renewable. And PRISM has the ability to better support renewables because we can change power so that when the wind suddenly stops or picks up, PRISM is more responsive than our current water-cooled reactors. So I see great synergy mixing renewables with PRISM. And the reason why you want to head to advanced reactor technology is what we sometimes forget is that on a per megawatt basis, you're pouring five times more concrete with some of these like solar or wind than you are with nuclear technology. You're using 10 times more steel. So when we look at sustainability on a system, on how many holes I have to dig out of the ground to make big towers for windmills or some of those, that's why advanced reactors should be a part of that mix.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is ultimately if you could fix the capacity problems that other renewable wind and solar have, wouldn't it be cheaper to build? But you're saying no.
If you look at,
and maintain.
I'm saying no, but it's, you know, there's a great professor at UC Berkeley, Per Peterson, who's done analysis saying if you look at how much commodities you put in different technologies, solar, wind, coal, and nuclear power, on a commodity, concrete, steel, iron, it's always less for nuclear power. So that's why it shouldn't be discounted, and we need to look at that fuller system of not only energy, but how much impact you're going to have on the Earth as far as all those other resources you dig up.
All right. Well, what are the next steps for you personally in your career?
Next step is to help GE Hitachi Nuclear Energy as a digital company get this PRISM reactor licensed either here in the United States or overseas, and then get that first customer to have the courage to say we're going to be thought leaders, we're going to be the first movers to be able to move this technology forward and really change the world.
Eric, good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Eric Lowen, Chief Consulting Engineer at GE's nuclear facility in Wilmington. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.